Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 27, where we're discussing the Journal of Management Studies, Body of Classic by Andrew Pettigrew. To find out more and to get the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Oxford in the United Kingdom.
And this is Tom, coming to you from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
This is Ella, coming to you from Sydney.
And this is Andrew Pettigrew, who's sitting at the Said Business School, University of Oxford.
So, for those of our listeners who don't know Andrew, Andrew is a professor at Oxford Said Business School and a truly prolific contributor to the field of management and organization studies. He's published widely and is, I would be well justified in saying that is credited with establishing a strong process-based sense of organization studies, strategy, and other types of organizational behavior. It's a real pleasure that you agree to join us to discuss this classic, and it's really wonderful to sit here next to you. And the papers we're discussing today are centered on your 1987 work, Context and Action in the Transformation of the Firm. So I think before we go ahead, it might be worth giving a bit of background about the reading.
Yeah, and I'll be happy to do so. So this article provided a summary of a larger longitudinal study into transformational change undertaken by a large British chemical company known as ICI. And the article presented a strong and transformational, if I may say so, critique of research in corporate leadership at the time. And this is indicated with a couple of rather provocative statements that begin the article. In times of uncertainty, it is comforting to believe that individuals in leadership positions can make a difference. There is, however, a large gap between belief and assertions about the potency of leaders in changing circumstances and the need to empirically demonstrate through careful research the what, why, and how of translating executive intentions into realized change. Page 655 of the article expanded that critique and said that much research on organizational change was ahistorical, aprocessual, and acontextual, and that studies of transformation were often preoccupied with the intricacies of narrow changes rather than the holistic and dynamic analysis of changing. Andrew addressed this problem by crafting what has come to be known as the Pettigrew triangle of context, content, and process, with context being divided into outer and inner components. And the purpose of the triangle was explained that formulating the content of any new strategy inevitably entails managing its context and process, which analysis from the longitudinal study demonstrated. And the article is credited with beginning a whole stream of strategic management research based on the large-scale longitudinal studies into the what, why, and how questions of management practice. In Andrew's follow-up article in 2012, which is also available, he commented on a number of other prominent management scholars who followed the same stream, such as Henry Mintzberg, who joined us back in episode 14, Andy van de Ven, and Kathy Eisenhart. The process scholarship that these scholars profess is basically described as how-to knowledge rather than what is knowledge. On a personal note, as an executive educator in the military, I have for many years gravitated to many of the models and frameworks in this stream precisely because of their how-to qualities. These models often have great explanatory power, particularly in educating practitioners who are looking for elegant ways to understand the complex dynamic environment they face. And so with that, let's get talking.
Yeah, I was struck by the similarities in the general direction of research when I read this work and thinking back to even our discussions of Henry Mintzberg, of course, but also Carl Weick's Enacted Sensemaking in the last episode, and Porach, Joseph, and Thomas Fuller in the episode before that, where we were joined by Sarah Kaplan. And it seems that around this time of late 80s or so, there was this turn almost within management and organization studies literature where suddenly context and process and the more human experiential factor became more pertinent than the more linear econometric approaches to management and organization studies. So I'm very curious about this time, these 86 to maybe 91 or so. I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit why you wrote the initial piece and what was the conversation like back then that prompted all these works that are now kind of foundational to what we do.
Well, I think one important factor was the changing business and policy scene in the UK at that time. And, of course, Mrs. Thatcher appeared in 1979 and had a huge impact on British society in a very controversial kind of way. And so her presence, the effects of the policies of her various governments. I remember she was prime minister in three different periods. You know, she won three elections. And this is one of the key issues about delivering change, is that you need the power to do so. And if you're a politician who doesn't hold on to power, your chances of having an impact are going to be marginalized. So British industry was under tremendous pressure for change in the 80s, and so was the public sector in Britain at that time. So the exploration of how these great changes were attempted seemed like the most obvious phenomenon to examine. And I would say that all my research has been very phenomenon-driven, rather than just method-driven or theory-driven. And I think this is one of the important foundational elements of my own academic history. I was trained by sociologists in the 60s, many of whom had been studying big problems in British industry right into the 1950s and before. And their work was very phenomenon-driven. So they were writing books called Coal and Conflict, Technical Change and Industrial Relations, The Dock Worker, and so on. So this had a huge influence on my own development. I wasn't easily seduced into narrow studies which were driven by equally narrow theoretical perspectives. So it was the most obvious thing for me to do was to explore change at that time in the context of the way that UK industry and the public sector was changing. And in 1985, I set up a research centre at Warwick Business School called the Centre for Corporate Strategy and Change. And this turned out to be a fundamental positive factor in my own development and also in the development of those people who worked with me. My maxim at that time was, in order to study big themes, you needed big teams. And, of course, doing this required a lot of leadership capability by the director of the centre and eventually by the other senior members, because you can't run an outfit like that and keep it together without a very strong team. So the kind of longitudinal work we wanted to do on these big phenomena of the day required team working. I couldn't have done this work on my own. Although the ICI study, which we might talk about in a moment, was done largely on my own. I had a research fellow working with me for the first 2 years, Dr. Dennis Bumstead, but thereafter, for the other 8 years of the study, I did it on my own. So that was another lesson. It would have been easier if we'd had a team doing that work, but in fact, it wasn't financially possible to do that. So these things come together. The circumstances, the interest in the big phenomenon, the decision to set up a research center, the ambition of the work, and the risk-taking involved in the work all contributed to the caliber of work we were doing. And I think that I would say one last observation was the state of the research at that time on change was very, very limited indeed. I mean, people basically were studying change projects. They were looking at, for example, the introduction of computer systems, the introduction of HR systems in company, or even the attempts to change structures or cultures. But they were doing it in a very ahistorical, very acontextual and kind of way. And so the work was very, very limited, and it was decontextualized, and this was a very, very, in my view, inadequate kind of way of approaching the scale of problems that we were interested in the mid-1970s onwards, was when I really started this work, because the ICI study actually started in the mid-70s and was completed in 1985. I think it would be rather difficult to do that kind of study today because of the demands of young scholars to produce instant outputs, often of a very narrow kind. And of course, people today are discouraged from writing research monographs. And I think there's too much fixation today about where people publish and not enough concern with what they publish. And this is leading to a downgrading of scholarship, in my view. And so I think I think the pursuit of big phenomenon-driven studies is just as important, but probably even more difficult to do now than it was in the 70s and 80s when I started the ICI study. So that's a lot of observations to make in one go. So please do interrupt me. otherwise, I might be tempted to talk all the time. And I think that wouldn't make a very interesting conversation.
Oh, I'm sure it would. It's so interesting that you said that, because we had Bill Starbuck on just a few episodes ago, and he said something very similar, that I think something to the effect of that there is a lack of sort of honesty and curiosity amongst the research field now, that with respect to this narrow publication journal fetish situation that we have going on. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, well, Bill and I share a lot of perspective together. We've talked about these things a great deal. One of his famous observations is that our community of scholars are very risk averse. And because so many people are risk averse, you have an advantage when you are prepared to take risks, as long, of course, as you do it in a profound and well-executed way. So it pays to take risks. And this was built into me personally by my own supervisor, who used to say to me in my early 20s, I got my PhD when I was 25, she used to say to me, "Andrew, everything is possible in life until proven otherwise." And that was a very positive philosophy, which I've had part of me ever since. And I was very fortunate to have a supervisor who had that kind of emotional confidence. Because to do creative work, you not only need to be technically able, you also need emotional confidence and the capacity to influence other people that the kind of work you're doing has some merit. So we're all in the communication business. We're all in the influence business. But if we're studying very small scale, trivial sort of things, we don't deserve to be influential. That's my view.
Is that why you agreed to do the podcast?
But yes, exactly. It is. Yes, exactly. It's no point in conducting work if you're not prepared to talk about it. And the best scholars and most successful scholars I've met in my 50-year career have always been great communicators and had huge personal energy and often ambition. And they weren't just technically competent scholars. They were much more than that.
When you were doing the ICI study, you've talked about taking risk. Did you know straight away that you were onto something, or did you have to sit with the uncertainty as you were following the phenomenon as to what it was that you wanted to say?
I had to sit with the phenomenon. I mean, I realized at the outset I had a huge opportunity. ICI was part of the British elite at that time, and nobody had got the kind of access which I eventually developed before, where I went right from the shop floor workers right to the main board of the company. And of course, this didn't happen overnight. I had to build the credibility and reputation in the company to allow that kind of access. And in the end, I would say I knew more of what was going on in ICI than many of the very senior people in the company. And I was in a very privileged position. And I was also very fortunate that ICI didn't try and constrain the publication of the book that eventually emerged. I had a contract with them that they had the opportunity to read and comment on the manuscript, but not to alter it. And this was crucial. And I also had the right to use the proper name. I mean, I could have done the ridiculous thing and called ICI Chemco or something bland and stupid like that. And as a result, nobody would have been interested in it, or very not in the same kind of way. Whereas I was on television at the time. There were articles in The Economist, in the Sunday Times, because I was talking about an elite institution in British society, which nobody had been able to get access to in that sort of way. So if you want to have an impact, don't throw it away by gaining access to highly visible companies and then allowing them to emasculate you by not using their proper name or by putting all sorts of restrictions on the publication.
So I want to talk about, as a result of this ICI study, you developed the Pettigrew triangle, the content, context, and process that Tom outlined in the beginning. I'm very curious about this framework, and I'll just say a few words about it. So it's a processual model, a description of Andrew's observations, and it consists of context, which is both outer and inner. Outer referring to the business environment and inner referring to the organization. Content, which is the focus of study, essentially. It's what is being considered. And process is the temporal dimension. So this bringing together of the different elements, how did that come about? How did you... All right, so I'll rephrase it. At the time of the study, the time wasn't a big thing in management theory. So to put it in context, a lot of work in organizational development had to do with what's called the variance theory, which is where you freeze a number of different variables and compare them against one another to see what is causing which. And then you come about and you say that, well, okay, guys, how about that this is a phenomenon that people experience and time is a fundamental aspect of that. So we need to look at history and we need to look at sort of direction and the teleology of how organizations are developing. And that is what's going to give meaning to our studies and give some kind of socially valuable insight into the work that we do. So when you were at the ICI, how did you, I guess, research this temporal dimension? We know that you did archival work of some sort, but I'm very curious in this future dimension, because we're talking about strategy to a lot of the extent here, and that is fundamentally future-oriented, something that doesn't yet exist.
Well, I think time is one of the most crucial factors in all the studies that we've done, and even my PhD had a temporal element. It sounds absurd, but before I did the study, which was written up in the Politics of Organizational Decision-Making, again, people looked at decision-making processes as if they were projects and didn't look at the most obvious thing, which is that decisions have antecedents. What happened before them often shapes the future pattern of decision-making. And my PhD looked at three decision processes in the same company, and it was very clear that these decision processes were all highly interconnected. You couldn't understand the third one without appreciating how the second and the first ones were made. So antecedents were critical, and this made it quite obvious that one had to explore time through its historical development. And of course, this becomes even more importantly if you're exploring change, or changing, as I prefer to put it. And the past weighs a heavy hand. You know, the past is alive in the present and is shaping the emerging future. So how could you not explore the becoming of phenomena by looking at them through time? And this has been the leitmotif of my work, and certainly one of the important contributions I think I've made to scholarship in my era, is to get the management scholarly community more interested in time and the realization that time matters. But of course, in much of the social sciences, it's an exercise in comparative statics. People seem to have no time for time, and this creates a huge limitation on the work that is done. And again, the present highly pragmatic academic culture that we have is even less receptive for people to explore things in a temporal way. But my compromise was to study time through a combination of retrospective analysis and real-time analysis. And remember, the ICI study was done through 8 years of real-time analysis and 20 years of retrospective analysis. I mean, nobody is going to give you a research grant for a 30-year study. At least I haven't met anybody yet that's prepared to do it, but they might give you the money for a three-year real-time study combined with the analysis of the phenomena over 20 years. So this is an obvious element of pragmatism in research, as well as a real blessing given to the importance of the historical method and the historical perspective.
I actually did something very similar in my doctoral study, but one of the sort of difficulties that I encountered there was that it's just me. So I am an individual research agent, and I am going about very localized settings within the organization, and I am only able to analyze and internalize things that I experience in those localized settings. So the challenge became translating that and interpreting it as an organizational matter, and taking these isolated bits and pieces of time and space that I construct myself fundamentally, because we can talk about the different the epistemology of time, but I'm not sure that our listeners will be as happy about that as I would be. But the thing is that it's still an isolated sort of a mosaic of research findings that then need to be analytically reconstructed into an organizational picture.
Yes, of course, that is the limitation of individuals working on their own and exploring complex phenomena. And that's why I suggested earlier the huge advantage as working in teams, because people challenge one another in the team about their perspective. And we often conducted so-called tandem interviews. So two of us were interviewing the same person at the same time. And we had the chance there to see what the other person was not seeing, what they were not capable of posing or asking in the interview itself. And then after the interview, we had the huge interpretive advantage of two people looking at a data stream and challenging one another about what it meant. So that's why team working is such a huge help. But of course, most people can't do that. They have to work on their own. And there, of course, there are all sorts of things that one does to try and deal with issues of bias, of interpretation or misinterpretation, and so on. And these include, of course, a sense of skepticism yourself about your own work, exposing other people to your work and your thinking at an early stage. And of course, the quality of relationships that you build with people in field settings. And I know that from working in teams, that some people naturally seem to get on better with individuals than others. So they're asking the same question, they're exploring the same themes, but for some reasons they're able to develop a more comfortable relationship, which allows them to ask more penetrating questions and also get more substantial answers. So there are huge individual differences in all this. But the bigger issue, I think, here is in doing this kind of work is the failure of many people to come to terms with the data they've collected. And collecting too much information uninformed by penetrating research questions. And this leads eventually, and I've seen many PhD students suffering from this problem, I call it death by data asphyxiation. You know, they collect so much information, they can't see through it. And this has led me, in doing the character of work we are talking about, to become more and more deductive and rely less and less on an inductive process. And I think the Glaser and Strauss, although their work actually is much more structured and demanding than it's often portrayed, have become great scapegoats for encouraging, seemingly, people to approach studies in a far too inductive manner. And so my own learning in all this is to become more and more deductive, clearer and clearer about the questions which are guiding and forming studies. And this doesn't mean that you don't have to rely on inductive pattern recognition. You still have to do that, but also in the context of a structure of some a priori constructs like context, content, and process, and time as a way of shaping the study. So, sorry, that was a long answer, but you can see it's a complex issue about craft. And this kind of work does require us to be crafty in the way we approach it, as well as develop good craft skills about judgment, which affects the quality of the information that you get. And I think the other thing I would say about the ICI study, which was important to me at least, was it was trying to set new standards about what a case study was. And if you look at the data collection in that, it took 8 years. It involved about 30 years of longitudinal analysis. It involved interviewing 135 people, some of them once or twice or more. So in the end, there were 175 interviews, never mind all the documentary analysis. And you hear, or used to hear at that time, people were saying, well, I've done a case study. I've interviewed 8 people, or I've interviewed 10 people. And I used to think to myself, what on earth is going on here? So, I mean, I was trying to set some new standards. That doesn't mean to say that everybody who does a case study has to interview 175 people. I mean, that's clearly impossible. But there is a huge difference from the quantity and quality of data collection in that study, and also in some of the other studies we did, which we haven't talked about yet, compared with some people's in our field's notion of what a case study is.
Well, if you haven't set the standard, you've certainly raised an entry barrier, so one can say. Let's maybe talk about this issue of contextualizing and the context that you articulated within these papers, and how leadership and management is more contextualized than is perhaps normally appreciated. And I couldn't help but remember that, Tom, you're doing something similar in your work as well. That, if I recall correctly, one of your tasks is essentially facilitating a recontextualization of people coming from one type of employment and moving into a more strategic, more abstract stage.
Right. And that's my dissertation was on the transition of folks from middle management to executive management in the military context. And that involved definitely a change of context in trying to get to understand what people go through as they try to break away from the context from which they came from and essentially acquire a strategic viewpoint, because the differences in the military setting between executive and middle management is very stark. You're talking about wholly different ways of communicating, wholly different ways of thinking, wholly different ways of approaching problems or even defining problems. And so what we try to do is to And I'm at the Army, U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. That's a big part of what we do in our resident program is how to take middle-level officers and essentially go put them through kind of an identity transition. And then some of the things in which we spend a lot of time with is organizational behaviors and kind of getting bringing this to something else that I'm working on, which has to do with organizational communication. We're trying to it, almost in line with what this article, the ICI study was contributing. We're trying to get people out of the mindset that the leader has, you know, total control and authority over, well, say total control over the message, and to put them in a context where, no, the history, the identity of the organization and all of these other factors play very heavily into how not only does the organization ordinarily communicate in its interactions with the environment, but what the leader's role is it in there. And so, like, for example, I was going to ask about Andrew, your comment about the importance of the political context in organizational change was definitely something that I definitely saw in the work that I've been doing.
Yes. And well, can you give me some examples from your work of the significance of political behavior in shaping outcomes in the military?
Well, I'll give you one of the case, and this, and I want to be careful about calling this a case because this is actually a first person experience, and I'm sort of writing a monograph on it. But there was a command that we formed in 2007. It's called the U.S. Africa Command, and at the time that it was created, its role is to for the U.S. military to basically manage all of the activities within the geographic region. And in this case, it was going to be the continent of Africa. The political environment was openly hostile to the idea of creating this command. This was at a time when the U.S. military was undergoing tremendous pressure in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Africans were not particularly pro-American. I'm being broadly, you know, intentionally broad here, without to avoid the detail. So, when it came time to form the command, there were quite a number of folks from inside and outside of the U.S. government who were strongly opposed to the creation of this command. And so the experience that I'm writing about is how did the leadership and how did the organization approach changing that environment from an antagonistic one to one that was ultimately much more favorable in the course of 2 to 3 years. The approach to strategic communication was almost entirely process without content or context. We were talking about the mechanics of communicating better. And so what I'm using this case for is to say, just in line with the triangle, the content of the message is extremely important, but not just the message that you want to send, but how you want to send it in terms of words and actions. And also the history is extremely important in that particular case, because one of the reasons why the antagonistic environment came up in the first place was because of a lack of attention being paid to Africa before. And we were foisting this, or I should say the perception was that we were foisting this solution onto a place that didn't want it. And it took those within the new command who had a strong contextual background, historical background about Africa to say, okay, if we're going to do this right, we've got to change the message, and we've got to change the message in this particular way. Is that helpful?
And that's all for part one of episode 27. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you're enjoying our conversation with Andrew Pettigrew, and if you are, please share the podcast with friends, get in touch with us to let us know what you think, or leave us a positive review on iTunes. These help new listeners find us. Also, please remember that we now have a newsletter that comes out every Wednesday, and you can sign up to that by simply by going to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and scrolling a little bit down. All you need to sign up is an email. Also, we now have announced 2 live episodes from 2 separate conferences. So if you think you might be attending either the OLKC in Valladolid later in this month, or the protest symposium in Kos in Greece, and maybe you'd like to say hi or get involved in some capacity, please get in touch with us and we'll put something together. Some of us are also going to be at the European Group for Organization Studies and I think the Academy, as well as some other conferences later this year. So who knows, we might see you there. That'll be fantastic. Also, we're now looking for an associate audio editor, which is a position to help us with editing the episodes and ensuring that the audio quality is good, helping out with the tech support for recording the episodes and all that kind of stuff. So if you think you'd like to do that and help us continue making the podcast, and this is a vital position that we're very keen to get some more people in, then please get in touch with us via the usual channels, which is either the website or Twitter and Facebook. So next week we're continuing with part two, and to find out what Andrew thinks of Tom's example, please join us then as we continue discussing context and action in the transformation of the firm here on Talking About Organizations.